Okay, so let's get started. I just wanted to remind you all that we are flipping the discussion and the lecture order for next week. The discussion is going to happen on Tuesday, the lecture is going to happen on Wednesday. I'm traveling on Tuesday, so I can't do any, have the lecture. You go to the same room you always go to. Okay, you will see the TA here on Tuesday and you will see me in the LGRC, not the LGRC, in the E-Lab on Wednesday. Okay? The first programming assignment is going to be handed out next week. So keep an eye out for the programming assignment. Okay? Are there any comments about the discussion? Is it going okay? Okay. If you have anything to relay to me, on to me, to make it better for you in any way, let me know. Okay? Excuse me, what?
It's really hard to
say. Oh, the projector is small. I'll see what we can do to make it. Yes, that's a long process, unfortunately. As soon as we get the key, we'll start using it. Yeah, they don't trust us with projectors. Anyway, so let's get started. We are going to start a new chapter today, process management. Okay, so two chapters are done. So please keep reading what's in the textbook, the stuff that we have been covering here. We will have lecture notes up shortly. Okay. Dimitri is also another TA for the class. He's taking copious amounts of notes on what I say. So he's going to type it up and we will have those notes up as well. Okay, so you'll have the slides and the notes to refer to in addition to the book. Okay, so just a quick recap. We were talking about how some of the underlying architectural features can be used by operating systems to make their job easier. We also talked about various architectural options for designing OS kernels. Okay, everything from a monolithic kernel to a layered approach to a microkernel to module based designs. Okay, so we'll take that background and today we will start talking about the first major component of the course, which is threads and processes. We'll start with process management. Okay, I defined briefly what a process was. We will revisit that definition and then we'll start talking about how processes are managed by the kernel, what do you need to maintain inside the kernel to do process management, and we'll build on that. And next time, next Wednesday that is, we'll talk about processor scheduling. Okay, so it's a two lecture unit. So we'll start with the definition, okay, and then talk about how kernel manages the process. Okay. So the definition is not different from what I said last time. A process is essentially a dynamic execution context of a program. Okay, very simply put, it's a program in execution. Okay, program is just code that you write or machine code that a compiler generates based on the source code that you write. Okay, when you execute this program, you get a process. Okay, so what does a process do? A process basically sequentially executes the instructions you write. Okay, the machine code or the source code that you write, one instruction at a time. Okay, and as far as the kernel is concerned, it needs to worry about what is called the state of the process. Okay, this represents everything that it needs to know about that process, okay, in order to manage it. So what does it contain? It essentially contains the three segments of the process I talked about, at the code segment, also called the text segment, the stack segment and the heap segment. Okay? And all of the register values of the process are also part of the process state. Okay, this includes the program counter. I'll show pictures of this program's process state in a moment. The stack pointer, the frame pointers and where general purpose registers and so on, as well as several other things. The sets are set of files that the process is currently reading or writing. Okay? If the process is actually communicating over a network, you need to track what sockets, network sockets, the process has opened and what, who it is communicating with. That's part of the state of that process. Okay? And the state, and what is called execution state, and we'll talk about that as well. What is the process currently doing? Okay, what state is it in? Okay? So all of this constitutes the process state, and the OS has to keep track of all of these things. Okay? It has, needs to maintain data structures that allows it to track all of these things for every process that is running inside the kernel, or that's running on the machine. Okay? So here's a picture to take what I said and show you how it looks. So this is, let's say this is some source code that you did. It's a piece of C code. It doesn't matter whether it's Java or C. C is just simpler to understand in this context. Okay. So we assume that the program has a main method, okay, and then it calls a method X, and X is just doing something. Okay. And we'll assume that the process has started executing and it's in function X. So it's actually here. Okay, that's what the program is currently executing. This is what the memory layout of that process is going to look like. Okay, so there is the text segment or the code segment. They mean the same thing. That is, this is essentially machine code that corresponds to these instructions. Okay, you are not going to get C instructions there. You are actually going to get machine or assembly code. But for simplicity, you'll just represent the program with its corresponding C instructions. So the program counter is a register that is going to point to this address in memory. Okay, that's memory, it's main memory, so it's going to point here. Okay, that's the stack segment. Okay, the stack segment in this case shows you the values of local variables and the values of any parameters that you pass. So you essentially have a local variable here that you see, that's the stack frame for the main function. Then you call X with the parameter and you'll see that that's what has been passed here. Okay, so that's the stack. There's a heap segment. Heap is growing downwards. Your stack is growing upwards. You have pointers to the heap, pointers to where the stack frame begins and ends, and so on. Okay, so the OS has to keep track of all of this. Okay, where is the process loaded? What are the register values? Where is the stack? Where is the heap? And so on. Okay, so that's the process layout. We'll come back to that. We'll have more to say about it later on. But as far as the process execution state is concerned, we have to understand how processes start executing and what they do, and based on what they do, how the OS tracks the state of the process. Okay? So we'll say that the execution state of a process indicates what it is doing at any given instant, and the process could be in one of these five states: okay? New, ready, running, waiting, or terminated. Okay? As the new state, as the name suggests, is basically the state in which a new any newly started process begins. Okay, this is the state in which you start executing, but the process hasn't begun executing it. So the OS is actually loading that process, okay, from the disk into memory. It's setting up the process. Okay, so when it does that, it's in the new state. Okay, and if the process is in running state, it is actually executing on the CPU, okay, as the name suggests. So if you are actually executing this process, it's in the running state. Okay, if you are ready to execute, but you haven't actually gotten a chance to run on the CPU yet, you are in the ready state. Okay, so that means you are ready to run. Okay, but maybe some other process is running at the current point in time, so you have to wait for your turn. Okay. So, but if you are ready to run, you are in the ready state. You could be in the waiting state. Okay, whenever the process does I/O, it goes into the waiting state. Okay, the waiting, as the name waiting suggests, you are waiting for this I/O to complete. Okay, so you can think of this as I/O or waiting state. Okay, so you issue a I/O instruction and you wait for it to finish. Okay, so if you are trying to read something from a file or write something from a file, as soon as you execute that instruction or that method, you will go into the wait state. You will wait for the OS, so that, as I mentioned, that will trigger a system call. You will wait for the system call to finish, and until all of that happens, you are going to be in wait state. Okay, and then you have terminated, which essentially says you are done. Okay. So when you are in the terminated state, the OS is deallocating the memory state for the process and cleaning things up, essentially. Okay. So this is a picture that shows you the state transition diagram of all the states that a process can be in, and from what state they can move to what other state. Okay. So you always start from new. Okay. Once the process is set up, you are going to go into the ready state and wait for the OS to schedule you on the CPU in one of the cores. Once you get your turn, you are going to be in the running state. You can run for as long as either the OS allows you to run, okay, or until you Yeah, the process actually executes any I/O instruction, file read, file write, any kind of I/O. Okay, if you do that, then you are going to go back to wait state. Okay, and then you wait for the I/O to complete. Once that completes, you go back to the ready state, and so on and so forth. Okay, once you finish executing, you are going to go into the terminated state. Is that clear? Okay. So you will see that there is an arrow going from ready to running and running to ready. Under what scenario do you think that it's actually the process is going to make a transition from running to ready? Yes.
Context switch.
Okay, you can do a context switch. Did you have any other thing?
When the scheduler is switching from process to process.
Okay, so the two answers here are context switch or when the processor or the kernel switches from one process to another. They mean the same thing. We'll talk about context switch on the next few slides. So essentially, when you get a turn to run on the CPU, depending on the CPU scheduler, you may run until completion, okay, or you may run for a certain amount of time and then you're thrown off the CPU saying it's time for someone else to run. Okay, this entirely depends on how the kernel is scheduling processes. Okay, if you have something called a non-preemptive scheduler, you will basically never make that transition. You will actually go only from ready to running, and if you do I/O, you'll go here and there. But if you have what are called preemptive schedulers, they are the norm, you will actually be given a time slot, or also called a quantum, and that's the time for which you run. Okay, and then you will make a transition back because it's some other processes turn to run on the CPU. Okay, so you may actually cycle between ready and running for some number of times. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so there are no questions. Let's actually work through a very trivial example. This is the Hello World program. You want to understand if you execute this program execute the program, what are the process states that this program will transition. Okay, so it's very simple. You basically have to trace your way through that state transition diagram and actually execute each line of code and see what does that do to the state transition diagram. Okay, so you will start with the new, well, this is the old solution. No animation here. Looks like. So we start with new. Okay, so you start there, you load up this program, it becomes a process, you go into ready, you wait for your turn, okay, then you start executing, you will go into the running state. Okay, and the first instruction here is an I/O instruction. You're trying to print a string onto the screen, so then nothing much to execute, will immediately go into the wait state. Okay, you're trying to wait until the OS will execute this instruction on your behalf. Okay, this is an I/O instruction, it's going to trigger a system call. Okay, so you will wait for that I/O to finish, then you will go back as that arrow, you will basically transition on that arrow, go back to the ready state, then you will run again at some point in time, and then the program is finished. Okay, so nothing to do, so you terminate. Okay, a very simple program, very simple set of transitions. You should obviously understand if we give you more complicated examples and ask you to go through some state transitions, you will have to list them. Okay, as an example for a homework or a potential exam question. Okay, doesn't require too much. You just need to know what the state transition diagram is, understand what the process is doing. Okay, but that's now let's try to understand from a kernel standpoint what is it doing when the process transitions from one state to another. So the OS has to maintain a key data structure to track all aspects of what a process does. This data structure is called the PCB, the process control block. Okay? This is the data structure that is going to track everything that's happening in the system. There will be one entry in the PCB for every process that's currently active in the system in any of those states. Okay? So think of the process control block as an array or a linked list where every element of that data structure represents one process in the system. Okay? And so what does that data structure contain? It basically has all of the information that we said we wanted to track. Okay? It will track the process state. It will tell the kernel is the process in ready, running, wait state and so on. Okay? It will have the process ID. Every process has a unique ID. I showed you that last time when I showed you this activity monitor. Okay? So what's the ID of the process? Where is the program counter currently pointing? Where is the stack pointer, the heap pointer, all the registers, the general purpose registers? There's memory management information. We are not going to expand on that. This is not one thing. There are many things here, including page tables and TLB entries. When we do memory management, we'll revisit this and we'll expand. Okay? This is a set of things. For now, we'll just say it's called memory management information. This basically tells us where is the process loaded in memory. Yeah, that's all you need to know for the moment. You'll have the owner of the process, which user started this process, what files are open for the process. You will have some pointers to state queues. I'll show that on the next slide. You may have scheduling information. Okay, if a CPU scheduler accepts priorities, okay, you will actually track that, saying what is the priority of the process. Higher priority processes, as the name suggests, get more than their fair share at the CPU, and so on and so forth. There's the I/O status. You can, if you're doing network communication, you will have a list of open sockets. All of this information is maintained in the process control box. So the PCB will have one entry each for a process. Each entry will have all of this information. Okay. So whenever you start a new process, you have to allocate a new entry in the PCB. So when you are in the new state, when I said you are actually doing some bookkeeping, you will allocate a new entry, you will fill it out, you will also load the process into memory. Okay, once you have done all of that, then you can execute the process. And conversely, when the process finishes, you deallocate its PCB entry for that process, and you then also remove the process from memory, you deallocate this memory. Okay. Now, how does the OS maintain the various processes that are in various states? This is best shown with an example. So for each of those states that I mentioned, new, ready, running, waiting, and terminated, the kernel will maintain a queue. Okay, and depending on what state the process is in, it will put that process, the PCB entry, in the appropriate queue. So here we are showing, the figure shows the queue for two states, okay, the ready state and the wait state. Okay, all the process, so these are PCB entries. So this is process number X, that's process number L and A and so on. So each of this represents, each entry here or each of this thing represents a process. Okay, so this is a queue of processes, and if you are in the ready queue, that means this process is ready to execute. If you are in the wait queue, as is the case for these two processes, it means these two processes are presently doing I/O. They are waiting for their I/O instructions to complete, or the corresponding system call to complete. So for every state, and there are five states, you will have this queue. Okay, depending on how many processes you have in the system, the length of this queue can be arbitrary. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so let's think about the, so I talked about ready and waiting, so you can now think about the other state. So let's think about the run state. Okay, so if a process is actually executing on the CPU, that PCB entry is going to be in the run state. But the run queue rather. Okay. So one question is, how long can the run queue be? Yes.
Just one, right? Unless you have multiple cores.
Okay. One. Yes. So it basically, the length of that queue has to be smaller than the number, greater than, or not greater, less than or equal to the number of cores you have in the system. Okay. If you have a uniprocessor, that queue will have either 0 or 1 entry, depending on if any process is executing. Okay, or no one is executing. Okay, if you have 4 cores, you can have at most 4 entries, because no more than 4 processes could be executing at any given time. Okay, so the run queue is the only queue that is bounded in length. Yeah, and is bounded by the number of cores you have in the system. All of these other queues can be unbounded. They depend on how many processes you have in the system. Okay? Yes. Okay. So what about hyper-threading? So we haven't talked about threads yet. Okay, so when we talk about threads, we'll see that threads are execution states of a single process. Okay, so basically each process will have multiple threads, and at any point in time, only one thread can actually execute. So that doesn't change that answer. So you can basically think of it as additional cores from a threads perspective. Okay, so you may actually have only, your hyper-threading, you may have slightly more entries in the run queue, depending on what is executed. Okay, but we'll not talk about that until we get to threads. Okay, let's not worry about it. Any other questions on this? Okay, so that's what the, so you have to assume that the PCB, the way it's actually represented, is a set of queues, and or a doubly linked list or an array, and each of them tracks all the processes in a particular state. And there are 5 such queues depending on what's actually happening. Okay, so that is as far as the PCB is concerned, and then we'll now talk about context switch. This was something that was just mentioned. So when we talk about CPU scheduling, all of this will become more clear. But That's why I'm trying to define what a context switch. Because a context switch are the set of operations the kernel has to perform to start, to suspend execution of one process and resume execution of another process. Okay, so we'll assume that at any given time there are set of processes in the system. Okay, some number n. Okay, and of that n, some subset of those are on the ready queue. Okay, there may be, let's say, 10 processes that are ready to run. So the as far as the OS is concerned, its job, if you remember the very first lecture, I said you have to ensure fairness in the system. Every process needs to get a fair shot at accessing the resources. This includes CPU time. Okay, so if you have 10 processes, you have to give them, each of them, some CPU time. Okay, so one simple way to do this, you basically have time slots and you allocate each process a time slot. Okay, the process will run for that time slot, and at the end of that time slot you will choose another process to run, and so on. Okay, but to switch from one process to another, you have to do a number of bookkeeping operations. You have to save the state of that process, okay, and load the state of the process you want to execute. Okay, and those operations and task is referred to as a context switch. Okay, so what kind of bookkeeping do you need to do? So if you look at the PCB, I said you basically in the PCB, you will keep track of the program counter, the stack pointer, general purpose registers and so on. So if you pick a process for execution, you will take these entries from the PCB. The PCB is maintained in memory, remember. This is just a copy of the register. This is not the register itself. Okay? So if you pick this process for execution, you will take these values and you will load them into the register. Okay? So then once you have loaded the program counter value into the program counter register, you can actually execute that process, and same with the start pointer and the frame pointer and so on. Similarly, when you are trying to eject a process or suspend the execution of a process, you will have to save its state. Okay, so all the register values must be copied into this data structure. So when you resume execution, you can reload them. If you override those values are lost. You can't then get them back. Okay, so you have to save the state and load the state of the next process. So do all of this bookkeeping is what happens during a context switch. So effectively during a context switch, the CPU is not doing any useful work. The OS is basically doing bookkeeping, saving state of a process, loading the state as actually it has to decide what's the next process to execute at the CPU scheduling decision, and then you have to load the state of the process that has been chosen to execute. Okay? So context switches can take a certain overhead. Okay, and then once you pay that price, then you will allow the process that is executing next to run for a certain amount of time. That's the time slot of the process. This is called the quantum that you allocated to a process. Okay? Typical length of a quantum, few milliseconds to hundreds of milliseconds, depending on the OS. Okay? In Linux, it's approximately 200 milliseconds. In other operating systems, it may be different. Okay, so that's just to give you a sense of every time a process gets to run, it runs essentially for, in Linux, it will run for 200 milliseconds max before it's ejected from the CPU and something else gets to run. Yes, question.
How long does
it take to do? So the question is, how long does a context switch takes to do? It will take somewhere in the order of hundreds of microseconds. Okay. So basically that's the price you pay every 200 milliseconds. If it's large, then you basically want the quantum length to be larger. It's a tax you're paying, right? So you want to amortize that over the useful work you do. Now, during a quantum, you're doing useful work. During context switch, you're doing bookkeeping, not useful. Okay? No process is making progress. The kernel is running and doing bookkeeping. So you want to amortize the length of the quantum duration such that the cost of context switch is small or negligible. Yeah, so what you are asking is actually the better way to ask is, how do you choose a good quantum duration? And the answer is you choose a quantum duration so that it's the length of that quantum is much larger than the length of the context switch. Okay? And the actual length of the context switch will depend on the OS, how much bookkeeping it is. It's not a fixed thing. It also depends on the speed of the CPU and lots of other things. Okay? Any other question? Yes, question.
Is there like a formula, a proven sweet spot for that?
Okay. Question, is there a formula or sieve? So there is no formula, there are rules of thumb. So you keep the overhead less than 1%, users don't see any problem. If you used to make the overhead much bigger, users will complain, think process seems to run slow because OS is doing lots of activity in the background, nothing useful is happening. Because we want to keep it very small, less than a percent, couple percent, that's okay. If it starts growing to 10-20%, that's too high. Okay, but that's just rule of thumb. Okay, it's not written that's the way it should be. Okay. So that's context switch. Now we'll talk about process management itself. Okay, so we know how to switch between processes, we know how to do bookkeeping using the process control block, we know a little bit about scheduling and switching. Now let's talk about how to create a new process. How does a process get created? Okay. First thing you have to keep in mind is some process has to create. If you want to create a new process, there has to be a parent process that actually creates it. Processes don't magically appear. Okay, some other process has to create it. Every process will have a parent process. Okay, and also basically when you boot your machine, there's a process that the kernel starts running and all the processes, there's a, in Unix is called the init process, and every process there can derive its ancestry back to the init process. Okay, so every process has a parent. What that means is a process can be only created by another process that already exists in the system. Okay, so the way this is actually going to work is a parent process will decide to create a new process. And then the way it does this is called a special system call. It tells the OS, I want to create a new process. That's going to be my child. If I'm the parent process, it will be called my child process. Okay? This system call on Unix is called fork. Okay? On Windows, it's called a create process system call. Okay? We'll just talk about fork here. They're equivalent in concept. Okay? So you basically, if you want to create a new process, you are going to call fork. You meaning the parent process. We'll call fork. That will actually start a new process, and then you can tell the new process to do something, execute a program. Okay, so this is the basic concept. Now let's try to understand how actually that works. So now let's suppose you go into your tablet or your laptop and you click on an icon. Okay, that starts up that process, that application. Okay, what is the parent process in this case?
Probably some user process at the time, mostly. You said click on an icon, get a
form. So let's say you want to start up Chrome. Okay, you double click or Firefox. You double click on that icon. Right? That starts up your browser. Okay, so every process has to be started by some other process. Okay, so who is starting that? Yes.
On Windows, it would probably be
Explorer. Explorer is the process you're starting. Who started that process? Who's the pair? Oh, Explorer, not Internet Explorer. Yes. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, is there like a scheduler process that kind of does that?
Okay. Scheduler, there is no process for a scheduler. Scheduling is done by the kernel itself. Yeah, so scheduler won't do that. So Explorer or the windowing system is actually going to start that process for you. Okay, so when you double click, your windowing system gets an event saying this user has pointed this mouse to this icon and has double clicked on it. So the windowing system that conveys to it saying this user wants to start this process. So it will execute fork and start the process that you clicked on for you. Okay? So in this case, the parent process of the whatever you started by double clicking is the windowing system, okay, that you used to click on. Yeah, similarly, if you go into a terminal and you start, let's say you type a command and you hit enter, okay, what is the parent process there?
The terminal.
Yes, the shell process. Okay, so you are in a shell, you have a shell prompt, it's an interactive shell prompt, you say ls or you do something, you say java something. Okay, the shell is actually taking that command and it is spawning a new process, it's creating a new process. Okay, so every process has to be created by something. Okay, it's not going to just start up by itself. Okay, so that's the thing to keep in mind. So there is always a process hierarchy, the parent-child relationship between processes. Okay, I'll show what that means as well. Okay, and we'll talk about fork, how fork works, what does fork do, how does it start. But just to show you the process hierarchy, you can, if you are on Linux, run top, or actually not top, ps3. Okay, ps3 will show you the process hierarchy. If you are Mac, makes it actually easy. Can go to his activity monitor that I showed you last time, and you can then say, show me all the processes and say hierarchically. Okay? That shows you the parent-child relationship between processes. Right? So here you will see, what does it show? Hold on. Okay, so here is Chrome. That's the Chrome process. And then if you open it, you'll see that it has spawned four child processes, some helper processes, some plugins and so on. Each of that's a process. Who started Chrome? You will see there's something called launchd. Yeah, so this is the launch daemon, because I have set it so that when I log in, some processes start up automatically. Okay, so when I log into my machine, the launch daemon says these are the set of processes this user wants to start upon login, so it will launch a bunch of them for you. Okay, and you will see here's the terminal, I logged into the terminal, there's a login process that started, a shell process and so on. Okay, so every process has a hierarchy, as you will see, and this is just showing you that hierarchy on this machine. And then this is the parent process. Okay, that's the kernel. That's the kernel. That's the thing process that started up when you booted up. Okay, and then here there is the that's process zero, and process one is the system wide launch D. That's the process that start boots up and starts all sorts of network services for you. You start up your networking card and all, load up the drivers and whole bunch of things happen with that launch D process. Okay, so that process on Unix will be called init. Okay, so it initiates other processes. Okay, so that's basically the process hierarchy. Let's go back and now understand how to create a process using this system call that I called fork. Okay, so you have to understand essentially what is happening in a fork. And the best way to understand this is to show a picture. Well, let me first explain, then I'll show a picture. Okay, so a process, when it invokes the fork system call, this is what happens. You basically go into the OS. OS says this parent process wants to create a child process. But at this point in time, you don't know what the child is going to do. Okay, so what the OS does is it creates a mirror copy of the parent process. Okay, so when you execute a fork system call, you create a child process, and the child process is an exact duplicate. Okay, everything, you just take its memory, all of its register value, just create a copy. Okay, so the parent and the child look identical at this point in time. Okay, they even have program counters pointing to the same instruction, except that these are two independent processes that are mirror copies of one another. Okay, but it's an independent process, it's a child process, it has its own process ID, different from the parent. Now, there's no point in processes just creating identical copies of themselves. That doesn't achieve anything. You want the child process to do something. Okay? If you double click on Chrome, you want the Chrome process to start. If the Windows manager does fork, you create a copy of the windowing manager process. Okay? That doesn't by itself do anything. Okay? So you want the child process to actually start a new process program. So you have a different system call for that. Okay? So once you do a fork, you have to call another system called exec, okay, which says execute. Okay? So then the child process will actually issue the exec system call, and in that exec system call you may say start up Safari, okay, or start up whatever you are trying to do. The shell prompt, you say Java, you say start up Java. Okay? So when you do exec, the following thing happens. What the OS does is it basically says, until you call exec, this child process is a mirror copy of the parent process. Okay? As soon as you call exec, what the OS is going to do is going to essentially scrub the entire parent process. It's going to take the new program that you want to execute and just override the parent process. Okay? So if you say Safari or Chrome, you will take Chrome and you will basically load it into where the parent process was running. Okay? Everything gets wiped out, a new process gets loaded there, okay? And then you start executing this new process. Okay, is that clear? What I just said. So you have to have a fork and an exec pair always, okay, for you to do use something useful. So you do a fork, you create a copy, a new child process, and then you issue an exec that tells the child the OS that this child process needs to execute this program. Okay? And the OS will load that program into the parent process. All traces of what was the parent process is the copy of whatever was in the parent process in the child is gone at that point in time. Is best shown with a figure. Yes, there are some questions.
Does the new process spawned by exec still know that its parent then is the parent of fork?
Right. So remember that exec is not going to spawn yet another process. Exec is just overriding the whatever the contents of the child process are with something new. But the parent-child relationship is maintained. Okay, the OS knows which process started this child. So that is information is not going to go away. Okay? And I'll show up if, yes, you had another question.
It just seems like a ton of overhead to duplicate an entire running process so that in the next instruction you can overwrite the whole thing with yet another new process? I mean, is that...
Yes. So question is, why do all of this? This seems a lot of wasted work. You're just creating a copy. Then the very next instruction is wiping all the content and just loading something else. So the way it's implemented is smarter than that. It will not actually make a copy, it just looks like a copy, but we'll come back to that. Okay? For now, just assume that's the way it is. Okay, we'll see how to reduce the how to optimize this overhead and not do something that looks this naive or stupid. Okay?
So the, yes, the process question. ID that when you first, you know, copy and port, is that what's
Yes, process ID, I'll show all of this. So as soon as you create the child, you get a unique process ID. What you do in the child doesn't change your process ID. Whether you do exec or you continue to execute the parent is immaterial. The process ID is not going to change at that point in time. Okay, so that is still going to be the same. Yes, question.
So I was wondering, if the child process crashed, would it prevent the parent process from crashing as well?
If the child process crashes, what prevents the parent process from not crashing? Sorry, okay. So if the child, so as after you do fork, you have two independent processes. Other than the OS knowing that this is the parent and this is the child, these processes don't even know of one another. They are two independent processes, they are merely executing. If the child process crashes, the parent may not even know of it. Okay? It may know if it is trying to do something special, but typically it wouldn't know. Right? So this is very simple. I mean, I can give you proof by example. You write a buggy program, okay, buggy Java program that you know is going to crash. Let's say you start it up on the shell prompt. Okay, your process crashes, but the shell has not crashed. Okay, the shell is the parent here. The parent continues to run. The child has crashed. Okay, because these are, once you start them up, they're independent processes. The crash of one, the parent may crash, the child won't know, child may crash, the parent may know, may not know. They're completely independent. Other than having a parent-child relationship, they basically don't do anything with one another. So another question here? Okay, so let's look at some code here. This is C code. Okay, that doesn't matter. What we really need to understand is how it works. There are only three things to keep in mind here. There's a fork, system call, and there's a if-else statement. Okay, that's the only thing you really need to understand as far as the structure of this program is concerned. And you have to understand there's some subtlety in how fork works. Okay? So you will actually, this is the parent process, you are going to execute a fork. Okay? So we'll take this entire program or a process and create a complete duplicate copy. Okay? That both of those processes, the parent and the child, at this point in time would have just finished executing fork. Okay? Because you're just the parent has issued fork, so both of them are here. Okay? Now, basically, the way fork allows the parent and the child to do some different things is the following. Okay? The return value that comes back from the fork system call, remember that what this is saying is the fork system call is returning a value back to you. So the return value is going to be actually different. Although I said they are exact mirror copies, there is only one thing different between the parent and the child. The value returned by fork is going to be different in the parent and the child. In the child process, fork is actually going to return a value of 0. Okay? In the parent process, fork is actually going to return you the process ID of the child. Okay? This is the way the OS is going to tell the parent, I created a child for you, this is this process ID. But in the child process, you basically just return a 0. Okay? And because fork behaves differently in what it returns in the parent and the child, you can actually then distinguish whether you are the parent or you are the child. Yes, question.
Is the child having the parent process CID equals 0 the only concrete thing we can predict? Like there's no way to predict the child process ID in that, so it always has to be else.
Okay, so question is, are you asking can the child know its own process ID? Is that what you're asking, or are you asking something else?
What the child ID is going to be before you.
Okay, can you predict what the child ID is going to be? You cannot. Okay, this depends on the processes are numbered sequentially. Okay, if there is 996 processes currently, you start a fork, you will get PID 997. You cannot a priori figure out what processes are running and what's the next process ID. It's an integer value that the OS is incrementing and you will basically get the next available process ID. So you can never predict. So the OS will decide what it is. Okay, we don't know what the process ID is going to be for the child. OS will issue a process ID, it's unique, and it will return that value in the parent and it will return 0 in the child.
Yeah, this is important that you understand that fork returns two different values. So this if else actually allows the parent and the child to do different things. Okay? So beyond this point on, if you actually execute this if statement, you are basically checking if the value returned by fork is zero. Okay? In the child, that condition is true. Because I just said process fork has returned a value of zero. So in child, this condition is true, so the child will actually execute this part of the code. Okay? In parent, by definition, this is not going to be true because the kernel, remember, the kernel is the only process that has ID zero. Okay? So by definition, all child processes have to have non-zero PIDs or child IDs. So you will get a non-zero value that comes out of here. So if you execute this condition, it always false in the parent and always true in the child. So the parent will execute this part of the code and the child will execute this part of the code. Okay? So you will see that in the child, you then go and issue an exec. Okay? So after you created this mirror copy, as you continue execution, the child will enter the if and execute the exec. The parent will not enter the if. It will actually come here and do execute whatever it wants to execute. Okay, yes, question.
So these are running simultaneously, right?
Yes.
So if the parent doesn't have sleep in there, what happens? Do they just like would you split it into two different cores, or would it just like attempt to run it at the same time?
Okay, so if the parent doesn't have a sleep, what happens? You create the new child process. Remember, it is going to go through its own sequence of execution. It'll start in the new state, then it will go into ready and it will wait for its turn to run. And if the parent is still running fork, it will be on the CPU and this child will eventually get to run. Okay, how this is, are independent processes. Okay, they will each get that turn to execute and so on and so forth. Okay, so any other questions here? Okay, so here is, I'm going to draw a picture, but here is a pictorial view of what is happening. So here is where you executed a fork, that's the parent. So assume that you made a copy of this here. Okay, so the return value from here is going to be a non-zero value. That's the ID of that process. If this is process 10, fork will return 10 here. So this variable in the parent will have 10. Okay? In the child, fork is always going to return a 0. So the variable CID in the child, in this case, will always be 0. Okay? So now, there is basically, although there are mirror copies, is one important difference. The value of this variable is different in the parent and the child. So the fork return two different things. Okay? And then you will use your if statement to do different things. So this is basically the child will execute this because this condition is only true in the child. The parent will execute this. Okay? So if this was a shell, for instance, the parent would go and say, go and issue a shell prompt and take wait for the next command to be typed by the user. Okay, that's what you would do here. This is not what you would do. If there's a windowing manager, you will say basically display the mouse and let the user figure out what next event to accept, a mouse event or a keyboard event. And in the exec, you will issue whatever you double clicked on or whatever command you type will actually be issued to the exec. So the child process will start doing what you asked it to do. Yes, question.
Can you go back to the
process. This one?
Yeah, the parent. Child parent ID, is that supposed to be different? They have both have the same parent.
That's a variable, right? So that is basically just getting copied just to show you that this gets a mirror copy. This is not the parent ID of this process, but it's a variable that you allocated. You just gave it value 334. The OS doesn't know this variable is supposed to be the mean the parent of this. So it will just get a copy of that. It is meaningless for the child. But because it's a duplicate, some meaningless information gets copied over. You cannot say this information is irrelevant, let's not copy it over. Right? So that's what it means. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so you'd better be, because your assignment that is coming up will actually make you program fork. Okay, you will actually do this in practice. Okay, so I'm going to show, but I'm going to spend a little bit of time here trying to see if we can then do a slightly more complicated example with fork. Okay, so let's assume, so you can, once you know how to do fork and exec, you can create arbitrary process trees. Okay, so let's assume you want to have a parent that wants to now spawn not one but two children, B and C. Okay, you can ask how do you do that. Or I could ask saying, let's say there's a parent A, spawns a child process B, and then you want to use 4 to spawn a grandchild process C. How would you do write code to do that? Or any arbitrary tree structure. Okay? So let's work through an example to see how to do these things. Okay? Question clear first before I start presenting some solution? Okay. So we'll start with the code for A. Okay, this is one program you are writing, remember. Okay? So you have to write code that will do all of these things. So you will basically write a program that says, this has to be in C. Unfortunately, Java doesn't support fork. We tried to make this assignment in Java. We couldn't make it work. So we are going to look at C here. Okay? So first thing you are going to do is fork. Okay? Okay? Yes. Sorry, what were you saying?
And then you check to see if it's the parent or the child.
Yes. So, I'm going to give you sort of a very formulaic way of writing. It's almost a brain-dead way that's always going to work. Okay, so what you have to do is, as soon as you do a fork, you write a blank if-else statement. Okay, it doesn't matter what we have asked you to do. This has to be always a structure of a parent and a child. You will do a fork and then you will write a blank if and else. Okay? And then in your formulaic method, you will say, this is what is the, anything that we have asked that a child do, you write that code here. Anything that the parent is supposed to do, you write that code here. Okay? This is sort of a sure shot. You write a fork, you write a if else. Okay? And then the if part is for the child and the else part is for the parent. Okay? And here you will basically, the condition that you will always write is, you will check whether the value returned by fork is 0. Okay. This is always going to be the structure of your code, no matter what the problem is. This will work for that as well as that. Okay. So now what have we done here? This is process A that did this code. Okay. What is going to go in there? And what is going to go in there? Okay, so we'll do, as soon as A has done a fork, it created its first child. That's B.
You're done.
Okay. So this is what your basically B is going to do. If I say make B print my name is B, you are going to just do some printf my name is B and you will exit. Some such thing. If I say make B execute Chrome, you will basically say exec Chrome. And you are done. Whatever the child B is supposed to do, this is where B goes. Okay, but the parent is not done. It has to start another process, child process. So where does that happen? Okay, so you are done with this, now you have to create another child. So this is where you are going to do that. Okay? So what would you do here? Yes.
It's an exact copy of everything you already have.
Yes. So you are going to recurse. Okay, so you basically, the parent has to create a second child, so you have to by definition call fork again. Okay, so you will call fork again. This creates a new child process C. Okay. And as I said, you do the usual brain dead thing. As soon as you do this, you are going to write an if and an else. Okay. And then here you will say j equal to 0. This is code for C. And this is basically the parent process. Okay? Is that clear? So you did one fork, and then in the else, which is where the parent continues executing, you did another fork. Okay? That made you basically create this process tree structure. What would you do here? Okay, yes.
You call fork in the first part of the statement.
Okay. You call fork here. People agree, disagree? Agree? Okay. So I'll write it, then you can tell me what happens. Okay, so here we'll call another fork. So this is code for child B. Okay. So here C is created by process B. Okay. So it's B that has to call the fork. Okay. The way B calls the fork is, remember what I said is, whatever code you write in the if is only going to be executed by the child. It's only going to be executed by here. Whatever you write in the else is only going to be executed by A. Okay, that's how fork B is, because fork makes the child enter the if and it makes the parent enter the else because of this condition. Okay, so you call fork here and then you write another if else, and then this is basically code for grandchild C, that is the code for B, this else is the code for grandparent A. Okay? Is that clear? This is the pseudocode structure that you need to be aware of. So if we give you an assignment that says create this arbitrary structure, you should be able to figure out where to put the fork. Okay? Here, here, depending on who is spawning what child, you have to put the fork in the appropriate place and then everything is taken care of. Okay, and execs as well. Okay? So one thing I didn't mention, which is the wait system call. Okay, so I talked about fork, I talked about exec. There's a third system call called wait. And wait takes an argument of any process ID. So what wait does is it says make this process wait until that process has finished. Okay? So in this case the code basically says after you spawn a child, the parent is just waiting for the child to finish. It'll just sit there waiting. Child can take arbitrary amounts of time. When the child finishes, the system call will say your child, that this not necessarily child, it's a process where this ID has finished. Okay, you don't have to give a child ID here. You can actually give any process ID, it doesn't matter. Okay, typically this is used for a parent to wait on a child, but the system call doesn't require that you wait for a child. You can wait for any process, valid process to terminate, and you will just wait or sleep until that time. Okay, so there are three calls, fork, exec and wait, that you should be aware of. Questions on this? Okay, we'll do another assignment, not assignment, review of fork in the discussion section, but if there are questions now, you should ask. Yes.
This might be a silly question, but if you don't sleep for one before putting in the wait, will the parent just continue because it
seems
that the child isn't ready yet?
Will the parent continue? It shouldn't have a problem. This is just the safe thing to do, but typically you though shouldn't have to do that, because as soon as you do the fork, before the fork actually returns, the child has already been created because you already have a valid process ID. If you have a valid process ID, then if you enter a valid process ID, it should wait. Okay? This is just a very simple way to say let the child start, but you don't have to. This is sort of not required. It should be correct even without that. Okay. So long as this is a valid PID process ID, doesn't matter. As soon as you do a fork, you have a valid process ID for your child. So it should work. Yes.
Yeah, but isn't that a problem with the scheduler more than necessarily like waiting for the process to start?
Yes, it's for the scheduler, but you are just going to wait until the process finishes. This may take seconds, it may take minutes, hours. You don't know what the child process is doing. So this parent is going to wait for an indefinite amount of time until the child finishes based on whatever it is. Okay. Yes. Any other questions? Yeah.
What's the use of maintaining the process tree? Like, why is it useful to the kernel?
Why is it useful to the kernel? Typically, you can actually write more advanced distributed programs where certain things can only happen between a child and a process, a child and a parent. Excuse me. Okay. So if you don't have that information and you do something which only a process parent and a child can do, and if the OS doesn't have this information, then you are in trouble. So there is a concept called process groups, which I did not mention. A process group can have a parent and a set of child, and they are allowed to do certain things that two arbitrary processes that don't have a parent-child relationship cannot do, for instance. Okay? So to do some, and we have not gone into what things you can do between a parent and a child and what you cannot. But to do certain things like that, you have to maintain that information. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So we talked about fork, we talked about all of this. So two other system calls that you should know is the exit system call. Okay. If you call exit. You basically terminate yourself, the process that calls it. Okay. The other one is called kill. This is basically a way for one process to terminate a different process. Exit terminates yourself, kill allows you to terminate some other process. Okay, so if you basically say spawn a process B and have the parent kill that process, you basically go here, the code for A will be kill, and you put the process ID, that will immediately terminate your child. Okay. Okay. Now, by definition, you can kill any process so long as you have the right privileges to do that. It's not that a parent can only kill a child process. You can kill any arbitrary process. If you have privileges to do it, the OS will allow you to terminate that process. Okay. Typically, a user can terminate any process that belongs to that user. That is what an OS will allow. Typically, a user cannot terminate a process that belongs to another user. Okay? Only the root user or the super user can terminate any process, regardless of what user that process belongs to. Okay? So the only restriction on kill is that it will see who is the owner of that process, and if the process you are trying to kill also belongs to the same owner, then your kill will succeed. If the process, the owners are different, then the kill will fail. So you do not have the rights to kill that other process. Okay, that's just for protection. So you can't have some user go around merrily terminating some other user's processes. Okay, not allowed. Okay, so this is the very simple code that says you fork, and then here is where you are going to kill the child. Okay, that's what I said here, saying if you want the parent to kill the child instead of waiting for it, you kill. Okay, but that's typically not what you would do. There's no point creating a child and terminating it as useless work. But this is just code to do that. Okay? Okay. So, we have a little bit of time. So, let's keep talking about other aspects of process management. So, we'll talk about cooperating process. Okay, this is where we'll start getting into synchronization. Although we'll actually talk about synchronization in the context of threads, you can also do synchronization for processes. I'm assuming those of you who have 230 background have actually done threading and locks and mutexes and semaphores, so you know what synchronization means. If you don't, that's okay. We'll talk about synchronization at length in about two lectures or so. But here we'll start talking about some basic concepts that involve synchronization. Okay, so as I said, typically if you take any two arbitrary processes in the system, you can say either take process I and process J. Either they are independent processes or they are called cooperating processes. If they are working together on some task, they are called cooperating processes. If they are totally arbitrary processes doing their own thing, they are called independent processes. By default, processes are assumed to be independent. Okay? Typically, sometimes the cooperating processes are the ones that are parent-child relationship. Okay? I just showed an activity monitor. I showed Chrome had three other processes. Okay, there's a helper process and a plugin process. If you take that group, those will be cooperating processes. The plugin is helping the browser do something. Okay, they are working together to do something. So those will be cooperating. If you take Chrome and let's say PowerPoint or Word, independent processes. They don't do anything with one another. So given any two processes, any pair of processes, they could either cooperate or be independent. Now, if they are cooperating, what are they trying to do? They try to execute a larger application. Okay, this is either a parallel or a distributed application. Okay, they are working together to achieve some task. Okay, depending on what application you are writing, maybe a client and a server. One process may be sending work or request to another process. That other process, which we will call a server, is executing the request and sending back results. Or you could be doing a variety of other things. Okay. So when we come back to distributed systems, we'll talk about cooperating processes, except that these processes will be on different machines. Okay. Here we are talking about cooperating processes that run on the same machine. Okay. In distributed systems, you have these processes cooperate, but they run on arbitrary machines. In parallel computing or parallel processing, these are processes that run on the same machine. Well, or they could even be threads within a process, as we'll see in a little bit. Okay. Here is the canonical example of what cooperating processes can do. Okay, this is called the producers and consumers problem. Okay? So here you have two types of processes, some called producers, some called consumers. Okay, producers produce work, okay, and they send them to consumers. Work would be computation, it could be data. Consumers actually accept this work and do something with it. Okay? The producers consumer problem is one where how do you actually transfer the work that the producer has generated to the consumer. Okay, so for those of you who did 230, did you do producers consumers? Assume yes. Yeah, so at least some of you know what I'm talking about, but here is the pseudo code. Okay, so we'll assume that the work is represented as a data item. It's a request or a string or some data that you're passing. So you want to essentially send data from producers to consumers. Okay? So I will put sort of two columns of code. This is the producer process
that's the consumer process. It could also be the producer thread and the consumer thread, but we didn't talk about thread, so don't worry about it. Okay? So all that we do is what we have is between the producer and the consumer, there's something called a shared buffer. Okay, this is a shared array. Okay, this array is accessible both to a producer and a consumer. What the producer will do is it will produce an item and will stick it into the array. Okay? Basically, it's a here is some work, I'm going to put that request into the array. What the consumer will do, it both sit in an infinite loop. Okay, this one just keeps producing, that one just keeps consuming. So it basically takes the next element from the array and do some work. You consume it. Okay? So that's at a very high level what a producer and consumer would do. Producer would produce work, stick data and put it in a buffer. Consumer would consume that. Right? Okay? Now remember that the way the code is written is this array is a circular buffer. Okay, you don't have infinite buffers here. You have a finite buffer of size n, here n equals 100. So you are going to cycle. If the producer has produced enough data items that it reaches the end of the array, it's going to cycle back and start putting items at the beginning. So you will basically cycle. It's called a circular buffer. Okay, I don't know if you actually learned about circular buffers. Okay, you could have other data structures. This one is a circular buffer. Okay, several things here that I didn't mention. Okay, first is you have to have the reason you have to do, why do you have to synchronize here? Okay, you can ask what is synchronization, what does cooperating processes mean? You want to ensure that producers and consumers work in a way that actually achieve their goals and don't trample on one another. Okay, what does that trampling mean? So a producer, let's say the producer runs and it very quickly fills up the entire buffer. It produces 100 units of work and it fills the entire array. Okay. Now if it wants to produce 101st unit, the buffer is full. There's no way to put that data. Okay? So then you have to wait. You have to coordinate with the consumer saying, let the consumer run and actually empty some slots in this buffer, then I can put the next item. Okay? So you'll have to do synchronization to achieve this. So you will make sure the buffer doesn't overflow. Similarly, the consumer has to ensure that there is something in the buffer before it can do something. The buffer is empty, there is nothing to consume, there is no work to do. In that case, it has to wait for the producer to produce something. Okay? So that synchronization is where you are actually ensure cooperation. So I'm going to show how you do this at a process level today. Okay? When we come back to threads, we'll also see how you do this with locks and things like that. Okay? There are two ways to do this at the process level, using what's called message passing or something called shared memory. Okay? So in message passing, there is an abstraction called message passing where you can actually send a message from one process to another. Yeah, so it's like sending a mail or whatever, some message. Yeah, so the same abstraction the OS will allow you. So what you will do is you'll produce an item and you'll say here is the data and this is the ID of the process to whom I want to send this message. And the OS will actually take this message, which is a data item, and give it to the consumer. Okay? All that the consumer has to do, so you have a send method here. So whenever you have message passing, you will have two system calls called send and receive. Okay, so you will send the message using the send call, okay, and you will receive the message using the receive call. Okay, this is. Are you allowed to send pointers? No, you cannot send pointers because a pointer is an address in your process space. Other processes do not have access to it. For writing threading code, that's a different problem. You can actually send pointers, but if you are these are independent processes, a pointer that you send from here to there is meaningless. If you try to access that process will crash. So that you cannot access this process's memory. We talked about protection, is that you can't touch somebody else's memory. Okay? So you can send a message, you give that to the OS will deliver it. A very simple form of cooperation. Okay? Really here you don't have to do synchronization at all. Okay? Because the OS is taking care of it. It's actually accepting messages and giving them to the consumer. But that's one way by which you can implement producers and consumers. So here is a slightly more interesting way, which is using what is called shared memory. So what happens in shared memory? I draw a picture here. Okay, so there's a producer process P, consumer process C. Incidentally, this is what is called a single producer, single consumer problem. Okay. This problem can be generalized so that there are arbitrary numbers of producers and arbitrary numbers of consumers. Okay, we'll talk about that code as well. Okay. So what happens if you use what is called shared memory is that these processes have to allocate a special piece of memory. Okay? And this piece of memory is called shared memory, and as the name suggests, this region of memory is accessible to both processes. Okay? Typically, this process cannot access anything in this process's address space, C cannot access anything in P's address space. So there is no way to actually share information at all. The way you do this, you will allocate what's called a shared memory segment. There's a special segment that will actually be mapped onto both of these processes. Both processes can access it. Okay, so you have to issue a special system call which says allocate a shared memory segment. Okay, and both of those processes can then actually look at that shared memory segment and do something with it. Okay. So if you allocate shared memory, then the producer also, this can be an array. Okay, you can have a shared memory region of arbitrary size, just as you allocate an array in Java or whatever, or C, C++, you can allocate a shared memory segment. So then the producer can then start adding items here and the consumer can start consuming it. You still have to do synchronization to ensure that the shared memory region is neither going to see an overflow or an underflow. But this is the OS mechanism that you are going to use to implement shared, producers, consumers. Okay? So the system call to do that is called mmap. Okay, so you're actually mapping a memory region, and then you have to have this shared thing argument which says this piece of memory has to be marked shared, and I'm going to share it between the producer and consumer. Okay, now look at the structure of this code. Okay, so you basically start off and you allocate a shared memory region. Okay, so at this point there is neither a producer nor a consumer. There's just one main process that's allocated a shared memory segment. Okay. And then you are going to call fork. Okay. Fork is going to create a child process. Okay. Then what is going to happen here is the parent is going to execute the producer code and the child is going to execute a consumer code. Okay. So in the if part here, the other way around actually. Well, it says not equal to 0. So the parent will actually do the producer, the child will do the consumer. Okay. And because you did fork, this shared memory region, okay, is the only piece of memory that's common to these two processes. Okay, so think of it as the following. Okay, so basically you have this initial process. Let me use red. Okay, so when it starts up, it is going to call that mmap and create a shared region. So this, let's say, is a shared region of memory. Okay, so then what you are going to do is you are going to call fork. So think of it that fork creates a copy of this process, but think of it as the process is laid out, the C process is laid out like this. Okay? There's an overlap between P and C, and that is precisely that shared memory region. Okay? The rest of it, neither of them can access. P cannot access this part, C cannot access that part. But this, both of them can access because it's a shared memory region. Okay? So that's what the fork did after the mmap, and then the producers and consumers can then share this region to enter their whatever they're producing and consuming. Okay? So this is what you would do if you wanted to write two processes that have to communicate with one another. Okay, here the communication is enabling producers and consumers, but if it's any other form of cooperation or coordination, you have to essentially use shared memory. So when you come to threads, you will see a lot of this is simplified. You don't have to do any of this. The entire address space is shared between threads. But if you are doing processes, because processes are independent, you have to do something special to ensure all of this. Any questions here? Is it clear what shared memory is? It's a piece of memory that is explicitly shared across processes. By definition, no region of memory is shared across processes. Each process gets its own address space that no other process can access. Okay, shared memory relaxes that assumption, explicitly allows you to share regions of memory with other processes. Okay? Alright, so we are going to wrap up. We are almost out of time. So we started with the definition of a process. Okay, I said process is a unit of execution, it's a program in execution. We talked about the data structure the OS uses to maintain processes, track state of processes, that's the PCB. You have to know what is in a PCB. Okay? We talked about the various states through which a process transitions. Okay, that's how processes get created, they get ready to run, they wait, and they do the cycle, and then eventually they terminate. Okay?
So we talked about that. Then we said on a uniprocessor the run queue can be at most one in size, on a multi-core it will be at most the number of cores on that machine. We talked a little bit about what is a context switch. Okay, there's one bullet missing here. We talked about what is a fork system call. How do you create processes? We talked about fork, exec, wait. That's something you have to know. You are going to actually write code to do that. Real code, it better work. Otherwise, your code is not going to be valid for the, what the assignment is trying to do. So please understand that. If you have questions, come back and ask. And towards the end, I started talking about taking processes and having them do things together. How do you have cooperation between processes? Okay, typically, you will have to use one of two methods, message passing or shared memory. You can communicate. So to coordinate, you have to communicate. Okay, no coordination is possible without communication, whether in real life or on operating systems. So you basically, the way you communicate is message passing. You send explicit messages or shared memory. In shared memory, you are actually sending messages by putting strings or data into a shared region of memory and extracting it. Still communication, explicitly by writing and reading from a buffer, a shared buffer. Okay, so that's where we will leave it today. Next time I'm going to talk about CPU scheduling. We'll take this notion of processes and then see how to schedule them, what are the policies to schedule them and so on. Then we'll transition to threads. Okay, that's what is coming down the pipe. Okay, so let's stop here. So